Good morning, universe, and welcome to another day, redeemed from death and looking forward to life because of what our Lord Jesus Christ has done for us. You're listening to Sharper Iron, waking you up every morning with the law and gospel of the living God, drawn straight from the text of Holy Scripture for you, while a part of your morning drive for the soul here on Worldwide KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, and this morning we're going to watch Jesus getting to where he has been going, delivered over to be crucified by the hands of lawless men. That's you and me, although in the text it's Pontius Pilate and the Pharisees, the king of the Jews, hung up for all to see. And what is written? Well, now it is written. Whether you like it or not, this is history we're talking about. This is the inversion of the world, the great transaction when the Son of the Father dies for his enemies so that we might become sons of the Father in him. Looking at John chapter 19, verses 1 through 22, and we have on the line Pastor Joshua Palmer. He is pastor at Catalina Lutheran Church in Tucson, Arizona. Pastor Palmer, welcome back to Sharper Iron. I don't know if you were on, or if I was the host last time you were on, to talk about John's gospel and some of its uniqueness. So I'm going to throw this question at you, even though we haven't been doing it every morning for a bit. You know, John obviously doesn't look like the other Gospels. The other Gospels look alike. That's what synoptic means, with optics, or the same eyeballs kind of thing. John looks different. But with that, then, he's got these kind of marvelous themes that come up again and again. And the one that we've seen repeatedly throughout the last 2 weeks of study is light and darkness, and the war going on between them, and how, especially now in this night that Jesus is betrayed, how heavy the darkness is. John keeps mentioning the darkness, and he does so by bringing up the light of mankind, whether it's a pitchfork, not a pitchfork, but a torch and a lantern, or whether it's a bonfire in the front of the high priest's house. He keeps talking about these kind of lesser lights as Jesus, the light of the world, goes to die. I don't know, thoughts about that, and or thoughts about John's gospel's major themes that are going to apply to the text today, and then anything else about the context, you know, what's gotten us here, especially in the way that John looks at it.
Sure. Good morning, and thanks for having me on again. John is, like you said, just completely remarkable. And when it was written is kind of a question. We think it was written kind of late. Dr. Lewis Brighton at the St. Louis Seminary used to say that it was his opinion that it was written after John wrote the book of Revelation. And the focus in this particular section and throughout the Bible is the one that you're going to pick up on the other side of the resurrection. And it's when Thomas sees Jesus after he's resurrected, he has this incredible confession of faith, right? He says he won't ever believe that he's resurrected, but then he says, then Jesus shows up and Thomas has this glorious confession, my Lord and my God. And those two elements, that Jesus is the King and God, are throughout the gospel for one thing, but for another, are going to play heavily into this scene that's going to come up here. Because the question at hand, as we drop right into the middle of the Roman trial of Jesus, the question at hand is Jesus a king so that Pilate should crucify him? But for the Jews, the question is Jesus God? He said he was. So should we crucify him for blasphemy? And the answer throughout John building up to this moment is, yeah. Yeah, he is. And as we watch, I think you said just Jesus moving inevitably towards that cross and nothing being able to stop him from going to the place where he's going to die for you and me, it's remarkable to see. I think the other thing that deserves pointing out here is that as we've been working through, like I said, we're dropped in the middle of this Roman trial. Jesus is in front of Pilate. He was in front of Pilate yesterday when he did the second half of chapter 18. And yesterday, Pilate was mostly concerned with this question, are you a king? He asked Jesus, are you a king? Are you a king? And Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. If it was, my followers would have fought. And so Pilate says, okay, so just be clear with me. Are you a king? And Jesus says, I came to witness to the truth. And Pilate says, what is truth? But the point is, in this trial, Pilate is concerned with pretty much one thing. And I used to wonder why in the Creed, in the Apostles' Creed, in the Nicene Creed, why you have, like, Jesus mentioned, Mary mentioned, and then all of a sudden Pontius Pilate is mentioned. And it seems a little bit out of place where you're confessing the Godship of Jesus to bring up Pontius Pilate. But the reason is a really important reason. Pontius Pilate is a real person. We know things about him. We know that he became prefect of this area of the world in AD 26. We know exactly who he is. Prefect means he's not a politician. He's a soldier. We know the family name that he comes from. We know a little bit about his temperament. We have him in history. Josephus, the historian, talks about him. Philo, the Jewish theologian, talks about him. Tacitus, the Roman historian, talks about him. And the view is almost perfect for what John is doing here. Josephus and Philo are both Jewish, and they hate Pilate. Pilate and the Jews didn't get along. Tacitus has him as something more like a tough soldier who just took no nonsense. And both these things work perfectly with this scene. Because when Pilate gets to Jerusalem, and he's assigned to Jerusalem because Jerusalem is famously rebellious, is famously troublesome, when he gets there, he's a soldier. He comes with soldiers. They bring banners bearing the image of Caesar into the city. Well, we all know that the Romans worshipped their emperor, and so he was just kind of like bringing his church along with him when he came into the city, and the Jews threw a fit because, of course, this is the holy city, and those images don't belong there. So they went to Pilate, who wasn't in Jerusalem at the time, and for 5 days they argued with him to remove the images from the city. And on the fifth day, Pilate, and this just kind of gives you an idea of what he's like, Pilate sends soldiers into this crowd of Jews as they're arguing with him. And at a prearranged moment, all the soldiers draw their swords and raise them up in the air as if to strike the Jews. And they're not supposed to kill the Jews, it's just to threaten them and intimidate them. But as an example of how the Jews react, they all pull their shirts aside and reveal their necks as if to say, go ahead, take our heads off. We won't even live if you insist on desecrating the holy city. And this is just one of at least four known incidents where Pilate and Jewish leaders get into a fight about Pilate's beliefs about the city, about the Jews' beliefs, their religious beliefs, and all of that is going to play into this scene where Pilate is going to constantly be saying, where the Jews are going to constantly be saying, no, this is, Caesar is our king and nobody else. This guy who claims he's God is not our king. It's hugely important. And the sarcasm and disdain that Pilate has for these Jewish leaders is just going to come roaring through. And you need to know the background of that tone.
That's awesome stuff right there. So I don't even know how to respond. It's so good. What we're going to do is get right to the text because there's so much coming up here on the other side of this break. Sharp Iron, John 19, Pilate taking Jesus. What's he going to do? Well, you know, but if you heard it this way, stick around.
I was glad when they said to me, "Let us go to the house of the Lord." Psalm 122, verse 1. Each weekday, the servants of God at the LCMS International Center gather together to receive the gifts of God in His Word. I invite you to join us weekdays, 10 a.m., for a live broadcast of daily chapel services on KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.
Liturgical art is a beautiful expression of Christ's great love for us. I'm Kelly Schumacher, founder of Agnus Dei Arts, and I would like to help you learn about liturgical art and the beauty it portrays as you view it through paintings, drawings, sculptures, and altarpieces. I'm available to speak with your group. My website is agnusdeiarts.com, agnusdeiarts.com.
Hi, I'm Pastor Mark Hawkinson, host of Moments of Assurance. Coming up on the next Moments of Assurance weekend, I'll be sharing some thoughts with you about Jesus' words in Matthew 6 when he said, "Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life." Well, how about you? Are you worrying about your life in any way? We'll talk about it this Saturday and Sunday morning at 7:45 a.m. Central on Moments of Assurance Weekend, heard right here on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
The drama is high, the conflict is ready, and one of the most intriguing characters in history, if you care about character at all, if you care about people who are fascinating, people caught in tough spaces, people who don't see what's coming, people who try to do the right thing and yet can't make it happen, Pontius Pilate at the center as he, well, not quite at the center, right next to the man at the center as Jesus, the Son of Man, truly the most intriguing man in all of history, lets himself be the pawn of history for the sake of saving history as its king in John chapter 19, verses 1 to 22, again with Pastor Joshua Palmer. He's pastor at Catalina Lutheran Church in Tucson, Arizona. We're going to pick up at verse 1, where after delivering Barabbas, right, he's set him free because that's what the Jews have asked for, which is a strange thing. Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him, which is no small thing at all there. It's pretty intense. And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. They came up to him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and struck him with their hands. It's just kind of brutal all the way around, right? It's constant mockery, constant attacking. Some of this is perhaps the Herod connection in here, I believe, as well. It's just John is just kind of mashing it all together. Pilate went over again and said to them, this is to the Jews, "See, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him." And yesterday, Pastor Danzer mentioned this is like this now is the second. Yesterday was the first of three official verdicts, right? Mm-hmm. I, the judge, say not guilty. Which is kind of important, you know, normally, right? So Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." In Latin, it would be "Ecce homo." It's pretty important as well, though, you know, I don't know why. It just strikes me as huge, though. When the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him, crucify him." So their response to the verdict of not guilty is kill him. Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him." Here's the third one. "For I find no guilt in him." The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die, because he has made himself the Son of God." So like Pastor Palmer was saying earlier, what is the conviction here? The conviction is claimed deity. When Pilate heard this statement, though, he goes the other way, right? He was even more afraid. He's like, wait a minute, this is superstitious, right? I'm nervous. He entered his headquarters again and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" And I hear that as an authentic question there, Pastor Palmer. Mm-hmm. He's like actually wanting to know. But Jesus gave him no answer. Now he's a sheep before the slaughterer, right? So Pilate said to him, "You will not speak to me." You get some of the angry soldier coming out. "Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" And now Jesus speaks. "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." Powerful words in their own right. Yeah, I'm sure you see a lot of stuff in there. Where do you want to go?
So let's start at the beginning. And I am in addition to being the assistant pastor at Catalina, I'm the chaplain at the University of Arizona for our campus ministry there, which is called the Hold Fast Fellowship. And when you're on campus, you get used to giving trigger warnings, right? So we're dropped into a story, and this is going to be brutal. And we're not gonna focus on things just for the brutality's sake, because that's not necessary. But there is something here that has to be seen, and I want to focus kind of everybody's mind eye on Jesus as he's standing in front of Pilate. When they take him out, when Pilate has him flogged, he's doing it for a purpose. He's going to parade Jesus in front of the Jews. He thinks he's not guilty. And he's going to try and engage their pity to get him off, because Pilate doesn't want to crucify this guy. And so he has him flogged, which to you and me, we think, well, that's the opposite of, like, you know, trying to get him let off. But that's not the way Pilate or the Romans would have thought. Flogging was a perfectly acceptable way of dealing with this. And we know from history that the Romans did this all the time. There were, in fact, rules. If you're a free man, you can only have a rod used on you. If you're a soldier, you can only have a stick used on you. But if you're like Jesus, you're not a citizen, you're not a free man, you're not a soldier, then you get the scourge. And everybody's heard Good Friday sermons where the scourge and its effects are detailed. But You know, it's a horrible weapon that involves the tearing of the flesh in addition to whipping. And the point of bringing this out, again, is to look at Jesus. So when the soldiers twist together a crown of thorns and they take and they put a robe on him, a purple robe, probably not like royal purple, probably more like a reddish purple like a cavalryman would have worn, was probably sitting around somewhere within the barracks. And they put it on him and they bring him out and they're smacking him and they're yelling, "Hail, King of the Jews," to him. What you need to see, it is a really, really, really abused man. You need to see him wrapped in this robe, but because of the flogging, there's probably blood dripping off the ends of the robe and onto the floor. You need to see that probably his face is pretty bruised up at this point because he's been getting hit a lot all night. You need to see that crown of thorns. Probably the point wasn't to inflict a lot of pain, although they weren't trying to be comfortable either. The point was mockery, mostly. But any time you get little cuts on your head or on your face, they're going to bleed a lot. And so as we picture him in our imagination, you need to picture, and I mean this in a technical way, the most pitiful of figures, a figure who is completely overcome, completely bleeding, and just being brutally mocked. And of course, when you hear thorns, you immediately think of Genesis 3, where because of Adam's sin, all of a sudden thorns are coming out of the earth, and now they're placed on Jesus' head. But there's another element here with this whole world dressing him up like this that we have to bring out real quickly before we go on to the rest of the thing. I want to introduce the idea of irony. And in literature, irony has a technical definition. Irony is when you and I as the audience see something that the characters in the story don't see. And when they put this crown of thorns on him, it was likely a plant that has thorns that can be up to 12 inches long. You have this hat on Jesus that has these huge spikes sticking out of it. Well, do you know the only way anybody would have seen a picture of Caesar? It would have had to have been on a coin because nobody sees Caesar and photographs aren't invented. So the only time you see a picture of Caesar is going to be on a coin. And of course, at this point in Roman history, Caesar is divine Caesar. He's part God, right? And so on the coin is the head of Augustus Caesar. And coming out of his head is something the equivalent of our halos, except it's like shiny bursts of light and divinity coming out of his head, like spikes coming out of his head. So that when we see the Roman soldiers dressing Jesus up like this and mocking him, what you and I see, this is the ironic part, what you and I see is that they're actually making him to look like divine Caesar. And you and I know that he is the divine king. They just don't. They can't see it. And so they're mocking, but you and I are looking at this going, oh my gosh, this is the God king. And they're like hitting him and stuff. Now, Pilate is doing this with the thought in mind that this is obviously not a king. But what John's point is that, and again, this is irony, Jesus being a king and crucified are not mutually exclusive. John 3 said he would be lifted up for all the world to see and draw all the world to him. And what John is bringing to us is a new kind of king, a new kind of kingdom, one that is powerful in weakness, one that gets its way even when all the power of the known world is arrayed against it, one that gets his way and dies for us, even though he is the king. And that's what you're to see when you look at Jesus. So that when Pilate brings him out and they're standing in front of the crowd, and like you pointed out, it's just so gorgeously, he says, "This man's not guilty." And he comes out there, and he's got the thorns and the robe, and I can't help but imagining that there's blood on the pavement around him. And he says that gorgeous thing, "Behold the man." And Pilate is hoping they'll change their mind, right? He thinks their charge lacks seriousness. He's annoyed that they've brought Jesus to him. One depiction of Pilate in fiction
has him having a migraine the whole time, and he's just done with this. This is stupid. He despises Jesus, too, because this man is no threat. And he says, behold the man, and literally, look at this pitiful, powerless, bleeding, swollen man. He's nothing to me, right? He's standing there next to Pilate, who's, I assume, a big soldier and probably wearing nice clothes. And here's Jesus, just bleeding and bruised and his face all contorted. Behold the man. Theologically, though, we have to point out that this is the demand of Christianity. Behold the man. This is what we say Christianity is. Look at Jesus. Look at what he's done. Look at who he is and see the salvation of the world. And so, when Pilate, again, the thick irony, when Pilate says, behold the man, and if we're imagining ourselves in the crowd and Pilate comes out and he's making a speech and then he says, behold the man, and we all turn our gaze to Jesus. Oh, that's the thing we need to see. That's the thing that we have to look at when anything comes up in our lives, when we suffer, when we sin. Like a homo, behold the man that took it away. It's gorgeous. And when the chief priests and the officers start yelling, they don't react the way that Pilate expected. Crucify him, crucify him. You can almost cut the scorn that's in Pilate's voice. You take him yourselves and crucify him. I find no guilt in him. And this is not a real offer because, of course, the Jews aren't allowed to crucify anybody. The Romans are the only ones who are allowed to do that. So they refer to a law back in Leviticus, which is blasphemy. And I really appreciate bringing up the fact that they bring up the fact that he's the Son of God. Because ostensibly they brought him to Pilate to be tried as a usurping king. But the reason he was tried in front of the priests and the Pharisees was because he claimed to be the Son of God. And again, there is thick irony here because all of Israel is sons of God. All through Exodus, they're referred to as the sons of Israel. Through the Psalms, they're called sons of God. And of course, they're supposed to be the sons of God. This is their role in redemptive history. But they're not going to take it. They're intent on crucifying him. But this is a huge surprise to Pilate. Because Pilate's trying a usurper king, and he's found that he's not guilty. But they show up and they insist on calling him Son of God. And now Pilate has to do, this scares Pilate, like you said. And I assume Pilate is superstitious. You said that, I think, right?
Yep.
Yeah, I assume he's superstitious too. He's a soldier. He clearly is somewhat devout because of the story with the emperor worship. He hears this and he's terrified because he now has to ask the question, did I just whip somebody who's touched by the gods? Because, of course, everybody in the ancient world believes that this could happen, that you could have somebody, a prophet or a soothsayer or something, come along who's been touched by the gods, and you should probably be particularly nice to that person because they're touched by the gods. And so the Jews are claiming this guy is the Son of God. Pilate's probably heard stories. He's been in the country as long as Jesus' ministry is going on. He's probably heard stories about resurrections and healings and demon possessions and things like that. And then in addition to that, his wife has had a dream at some point this day. Right? This is in Matthew 27. It's recorded that his wife has had a dream and at some point during the trial sends a message to Pilate saying, I have been tormented all night because of a dream about that man. Don't have anything to do with this trial. And all of this kind of comes together in Pilate's mind and is cleared all of a sudden when they call him the Son of God and he's terrified. So I think you're right. He asks, where are you from? And this question is a desperate attempt to get at, is Jesus a normal person? And Jesus doesn't answer. And then comes, I think, the scariest, from Pilate's perspective, the scariest part of this entire trial. Pilate flexes his muscles, right? You're not going to speak to me? Don't you know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you? And the word authority in Greek there is exousia, power. Don't you know I have the power to release you and the power to crucify you? And Jesus does one of those things Jesus does when he finally answers and he turns it upside down. He says, you would have no authority over me unless it was given to you from above. And at least when I read that, I think of God giving Pilate the authority to do this job. But Pilate probably would have heard it as Pilate having authority from Caesar. And in fact, Pilate, one of the hardships that Pilate's going to face is that he has to be true to Caesar while trying to be true to justice. And when the Jews bring up that he's not Caesar's friend if he doesn't crucify this guy, Jesus has pointed out that Pilate has to do what Caesar gave him to do, and that Pilate doesn't have any authority. And in fact, just a few years after this, I think like 3 or 4 years after this, Caesar recalls Pilate, and Pilate disappears from the annals of history because he dies in obscurity because he falls out with Tiberius Caesar. So Jesus not only points out that Pilate's not actually got that much power, but then he does even a bigger turn, and he says, therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin. Pilate says, I have the authority to crucify you, meaning I have the soldiers, I have the rights under justice, I am the proper authority to do this. And Jesus says, yeah, that's fine, that's all well and good, but I have the authority to determine sin. Huh. What does that make Jesus? That makes him God. And so Pilate steps into this little private conversation, hoping not to find out that this guy is touched by the God. And Jesus ends up telling him he is God who determines sin. And what I want to draw really clear here is that in this scene, Pilate has all the power and can't stop this crucifixion from happening. Jesus has no power whatsoever, and yet indomitably moves towards the cross because this is what he came to do. And it's just a beautiful picture of God's plan for this universe. That God is going to get you and me saved from our sin, is going to get everybody listening to this freed from our sin and freed from death and freed from the devil, and nobody's going to stand in his way. Even as Pilate tries and tries and tries to get him released, Jesus is going to go to the cross, and you and I are so grateful for it.
I love so much of that. The idea that Jesus, without any authority, worldly speaking at all, right? No visible manifestation of his authority, simply by the conviction of his words. Really, in a sense, his faith, his certitude, his certainty in who he is. Mm-hmm. With that alone, he dominates everybody there. And as you point out, he dominates them not for himself, but for us, right? To move everyone else to the thing he has come here to surely do. I think sometimes people think that the crucifixion is sort of like the devil's win. And you get this a little bit because of, this is one of the places it's actually wrong, in the Chronicles of Narnia, the White Witch, like it's her plan. Like she really wants to kill Aslan and she thinks she wins. Biblically, I don't think that's quite how it's going. I think the devil's doing everything he can to get Jesus off the cross. He actually sees where maybe it's a little late. Maybe he was in Judas and kind of like wanted him, you know, stopped in some way. But I think he sees where this thing's going. You mentioned Pilate's wife's dream. So she has a dream, and the dream doesn't say, you know, this man needs to die for the sins of the world. You're doing a good work, right? That's what God would say. It says, get away from him, have nothing to do with it, which again is get him off the cross. Right. That's not what God would say. That's what the devil would say. So there's all these little movements that are trying, you know, even the crowds jeering at him. If you are the Son of God, this is Matthew again, but if you are the Son of God, that's the devil's language. Right. Come down off this cross. So I think it's potent that he, as one of weakness, wields all authority to do what no one, in a sense, wants him to do. Right. Really. I mean, obviously the Jews do, but, the true evil powers are arrayed against salvation, right? They're all trying to stop salvation, and,
right, and
he won't let it happen.
I'm sorry, this is the backwardness of God's work in this world, that just as he's standing there, probably his hands are tied, right? All the evidence of Rome's power sitting on his shoulders and dripping down his legs and pooling in a pool of blood at his feet is all in front of everybody. The weakness is so obvious, and yet Jesus' power in that weakness is just, you can't deny it.
Hmm. Now he just, I don't want to say he just doesn't care, but that's kind of the way we'd say it as Americans. Like right. He just don't care. Like, he's like, whatever, I got this, right? And it reminds me of, in some ways, not to invoke Nietzsche as if he's all good, but Nietzsche talks about the Superman being the one who has the will to do what others won't do and will move all others to that will. And that's exactly what he's doing right here, right? He's got the will, he's got the conviction, he's got the courage. What a thing. What a thing to pray for. Come, Holy Ghost, and fill the hearts of the faithful and fill them with the fire of your conviction. We're going to go on to read verses 12 through 16 here. From then on, Pilate sought to release him. You see, Pilate's now really not wanting to do this. But the Jews cried out, and this, you brought this up earlier. I think this is the pinnacle. This is like the shifting moment of the entire gospel. If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. So they're appealing to his law now. So when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat him down on the judgment seat at a place called the Stone Pavement, and in Aramaic, Gabbatha. Now, this is huge here. 14. It was the day of preparation of the Passover.
Yeah.
It was about the sixth hour. What that means is it's Friday morning at 6 a.m., which means the sun is up. The sun is up. What have these guys not done yet, the Jews? They've not entered his house so that they can still go home and eat the Passover, because they got to eat it before sunup. Otherwise, they're outside of the covenant. This includes the high priest, right, at this moment. And at that moment, when they should be, like, worried about this, he says to them, "Behold your king," and they say, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate says. The chief priests answer, "We have no king but Caesar." The old covenant's over. It's done. Everybody, nobody's under it, not just these guys. The whole thing's done. It's gone. And so he delivers him over to be crucified. The New Testament in his blood, right, really begins. And oh, it's potent. Maybe I didn't convey it well enough, but for me, this is just this is as good as it gets.
It's incredible, and we should draw everybody's attention to the fact that, like, Caesar's friend is an official title. That's like a title that Caesar can give out as an honorific, so that everybody, and it gives you authority, and it gives you clout in society. And we don't know whether or not Pilate had it, that particular title, but I think probably because the Jews throw it in his face like this, he probably did. And so that they're pointing out that. I mean, even if he didn't have the title, it doesn't matter all that much, because the point is made. If this guy says he's a king, and you say you are Caesar's servant, you have to crucify him. And so Pilate is kind of stuck. And if we're thinking about this in terms of the accusation against Jesus, the claim that he is Messiah, the claim that he is Christ, involves a claim that he is a king and that he is God. And so John wants you to notice that the Jews kill him for being God, and Pilate kills him for being a king. And John wants you, when Thomas confesses it at the end of the gospel, he says, "My Lord and my God," John wants you to say, "Yeah, that's exactly who this guy is, God and king." And what you were talking about, the preparation for the Passover, is so incredible. Because what's going on, as John has it, the lambs, the Passover lambs, are simultaneously being slaughtered. And we think from history that basically at this point in Jewish history, there are too many people to slaughter the Passover lambs all on Thursday. So we believe, and this is pretty well testified, that they slaughtered the lambs on Thursday and Friday both. The reason was because the way they did it was they said, okay, for you in Galilee, Passover starts at nightfall on Thursday. For those of us who are in the city, Passover starts either at midnight on Thursday or even possibly at sunrise on
Friday, probably at midnight on Thursday. So you have a little bit of different timekeeping. So a lot of the scholars will point to the fact that as the morning begins, as the day is going on through Friday, there are actually Passover lambs being slaughtered in the temple for the priests. And the connection between Jesus as the Passover lamb slaughtered for us and these lambs is gorgeous. Because, of course, this is a reference to the story in Exodus where Moses goes to Pharaoh and he says, "Let my people go." And Pharaoh says, "No," 10 times. And finally, God, in a show of pure power, says, "Okay, here comes the angel of death, and the firstborn of your animals and your people are going to die." And he says to Israel, "Look, if you don't want this to happen, take a lamb, don't break any of its bones, kill it, take the blood, and paint it on your door frame, and then when the angel of death comes by, your firstborn won't die." And so there's so many things in this single throw-off picture. There's the fact that if you paint a door frame, you have essentially the shape of a cross. You have top to bottom of a door frame and side to side of a door frame. That's a cross. You have the fact that this blood, which is been shed by this lamb, in Leviticus, the Passover lamb isn't so much about forgiving sins. I mean, that's there, but that mostly focuses on the Day of Atonement. In Leviticus and in Exodus, the Passover lamb frees you from slavery and protects you from death. And so what you're picturing is Jesus as his blood is, again, all over the pavement, that blood being applied to those people standing in front of him and protecting them from the very thing that they're trying to do to him. He uses death to protect them, to protect you and me from the effects of our sin, from death. That's what he's doing. And John is drawing our attention to the fact that this is happening at the same time and within this whole weekend of Passover. It's incredible. Plus, add to this that John 6 is exactly 1 year prior to this. And in John 6, Jesus feeds the 5,000 with loaves, and then they try to make him king. But exactly 356 days later, they're crying out, "We have no king but Caesar." And again, the irony is thick, and you and I are to see it. And so Pilate responds with so much scorn. He says, "What, you want me to kill your king?" And like you said, now the Old Testament's covenant is over. We have no king but Caesar, because, of course, God is supposed to be their king. When I was a kid and I was being taught, like, the basic ideas of what government is, I was taught Athens was a democracy, Sparta was an oligarchy, Israel was a theocracy. It was supposed to have God as their king. But, of course, This has been long coming. When Israel demands a king, the prophet Samuel, his feelings are hurt, but God says, "Samuel, they haven't rejected you, they've rejected me, their king." Well, now that rejection is whole and complete. They don't just want an Israelite king, they want Caesar. "We have no king but Caesar." And this is the giving up of the messianic hope, because, of course, the Messiah was supposed to be David's son. The king that they're supposed to be waiting for is David's son. But instead, they've put their hope in political power, specifically to get this guy killed. It's brutal.
More coming up on the other side of this break. Jesus delivered over to be crucified for you. Sharp Ryan, stick around.
This week on the Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah,
we'll talk with the Clausing family, missionaries in East Africa, and we'll explore the vocations of godparent and godchild with the Schuermans and two of their godchildren.
Pastor Paul Beisel of Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Iowa Falls, Iowa, talks about spiritual Trojan horses, and we'll learn why hymns are so important, no matter how you sing them.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah, weekdays at 9 a.m. on KFUO, underwritten by Concordia University, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm.
Worldwide KFUO Radio salutes our day sponsors on this Thursday, June 21st, 2018. Today's day sponsors are Herb and Faith Miller. Today's day sponsors have made a contribution to Worldwide KFUO Radio in thanksgiving to the Lord for their wedding anniversary as they celebrate 43 years of marriage. Once again, we say thank you to Herb and Faith Miller of Waterloo, Illinois, today's Worldwide KFUO day sponsors.
It was the fulcrum point of history. It was the day that is and supersedes all other days. The day of preparation for the Passover, the day before the Sabbath during the week of the Passover, as the man, the one man, Jesus Christ, stands in the place of all men, rejected by his people, God rejected by those whom he created, and yet through that rejection, taking death and turning it into the means of saving us from death. Talking about John chapter 19, verses 1 through 22 with Pastor Joshua Palmer. He is assistant pastor at Catalina Lutheran Church in Tucson, Arizona, and chaplain of the Holdfast Fellowship at the University of Arizona. And would you just take about 30 seconds here, Pastor Palmer, and tell us about the Holdfast Fellowship?
Oh, absolutely. So we were started by Pastor Ian Pacey, who is now serving in Houston. We're it's a Bible study and a fellowship and a group of students who are working hard to hold fast to their faith. We based it on Hebrews 10:23, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And so we come together on Friday nights at the U of A and we, University of Arizona, and we have supper together, and we sing evening prayer, and then we have about an hour-long Bible class, and God has blessed our fellowship. We have about 30, 35 young people who come together every Friday night for this. It's awesome. And as this is my first church out of seminary, I'm having the time of my life. It's so much fun getting to go on campus and evangelize, getting to work with students as they deepen their faith and as they're coming through adulthood. It's awesome. And if anybody would like more information about it, they can go to our website. It's just simply holdfastfellowship.org and find out about us.
I don't think there's any question that the college years do quite a bit of damage to young people in terms of their faith, and that many families don't think much about where to send a child to college with the question in mind, how will they retain their faith? But it's a question you should think about. And there are universities out there. It's not thanks to the university. It's thanks to the LCMSU connection and local congregations who support. There are universities like the U of A where you can find solid Lutheran church while you're there and a community that will support your child. So I do highly recommend considering the U of A. Not that I have any attachment to it, but Christ Hold Fast Fellowship or the Hold Fast Fellowship indeed sounds like a very good thing. Coming back to John chapter 19, we're going to pick up at verse 16, even though the edit brick kind of marks there. He delivered Jesus over to be crucified, to be murdered in the way that the Romans murder people as a torturous punishment to make sure no one else does what this guy did. So they took Jesus, and he went out, verse 17, bearing his own cross, carrying it, to the place called the place of a skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. So we have it like literally translated there. If I was writing this as a fiction book, I'd call it the place, you know, they went to the death's head, right? Something like that. It's just a really nasty word. There they crucified him, and with him two others, one on either side and Jesus between them. Pilate also wrote an inscription and put it on the cross. It read, you know, INRI, as you see this on your little crosses sometimes, right? INRI, that's the Latin first letters of Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Many of the Jews read this inscription, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city. It's a nice thing on Christmas morning, right? Some crucifixions going on. And it was written in Aramaic, in Latin, and in Greek. So the chief priests of the Jews said to Pilate, "Do not write the King of the Jews," right? What are you doing? You're going to confuse people. You're going to think, we really think this is who he was. "But rather write, this man said, I am King of the Jews, which has an interesting connection to some of the ways people hand out the Lord's Supper and deny the Lord's Supper. They don't hand it out and say, take and eat, this is my body. They say, Jesus said, this is my body. Interesting little irony of ironies there. This man said he's King of the Jews, meaning we don't believe it, but Pilate, oh man, this is great. Pilate answered, what I have written, I have written. And so it is. It is. It's encoded. It is history. It is done. You cannot change the fact, and it is indeed truth. So we got about a good 7 minutes here, Pastor Palmer, to fill up. So what are you looking at?
And I don't do Latin. I don't know if you do, but this looks like it should be something so tight and final. He says, quote, scribini, scribini. What I've written, I've written. And again, if we're beholding the man, if we're just watching Jesus as John portrays him, as John pulls our eye toward him, we see him carrying the cross, and I think we're definitely supposed to see that other sacrifice who carried his own wood, Isaac. And of course, when Isaac carried his wood, God intervened and stopped Isaac from actually dying. Even though Abraham was willing to sacrifice him because he had faith that God could resurrect him from the dead, Jesus does die here. And I want to talk quite a bit about that inscription that you pointed out. And you're absolutely right to point out it's the I-N-R-I that's above Jesus on our crucifixes. And the I-N-R-I stands for Jesus. That's the I of Nazareth. That's the N. R is King Rex in Latin of the Jews, which is, again, the I. And this inscription, it probably would have been pretty big. It would have been on a placard. We know how the Romans did this. They whitewashed a big board and then wrote it on it. And it's possible, there's some debate, that Pilate actually wrote it himself, because it says in 19 that Pilate wrote an inscription, although that's not necessary. He could have just had it written and it would say the same thing. But this inscription is pointed not just to taunt the Jews. We'll get to that in just a second. But you don't get in the ancient world things written in multiple languages a whole lot. It's just not everybody's concern. There's not a whole lot of writing going on anyway. But you do get this on imperial decrees, because if Caesar says something, everybody needs to know. And the three languages represented here are Aramaic, which is the popular language, the vernacular that everybody's speaking, Greek, which is the lingua franca. This is the trade language that if you want to go anywhere in the world, you got to know Greek, and Latin, which is the power language, the language of the army and the government. And the goal here is for everybody who reads it to be able to understand why this man is being crucified. Otherwise, the crucifixion doesn't do any good from a Roman perspective. So what you have here is Pilate making an imperial decree that this man, Jesus of Nazareth, let's not get confused with any other Jesuses, this one, Jesus of Nazareth, is the King of the Jews. An imperial decree. And he's right. It's the irony thing again. Pilate is saying something that is completely true, and he's doing it to taunt the Jews because he's sick of this whole thing and it's stupid. But in doing this, he's saying something that is 100% true. And this line about many of the Jews read the inscription, that's really significant, because at nightfall on Friday, everybody who is coming to Jerusalem for Sunday has to be in Jerusalem because they can't travel during the Sabbath, which is Saturday. And this Sunday, after Jesus dies on the cross, when he's resurrected that Sunday, it's a festival day in Jerusalem. It's the Feast of the First Fruits. And it's one of those days in Jewish religion where you have to go to the temple and present yourself if you're an adult male. So on this Friday afternoon, people from all over the countryside, anybody north of Jerusalem, which is most of the Jewish population, is going to come down through that northern road. And we believe that the Hill of the Skull is right on the path, right on the road coming from the north into Jerusalem. So when we say many of the Jews read this inscription because the place where Jesus was crucified is near the city, we're talking about a huge number of people coming into the city, trying to get settled before nightfall on Friday so that they can celebrate the Sabbath, and then the next Sunday they can celebrate the Feast of the First Fruits, which, by the way, is awesome. the fact that Jesus is resurrected on the Feast of the First Fruits. Just going to say that and leave that alone because we don't have time to get to it. But this is incredible. So that everybody looks up, they see this man dying, and it's a true statement. This is the King of the Jews. The biblical scholar F.F. Bruce said this way. He said, quote, "The crucified one is the true king, the kingliest of all kings, because it is he who is stretched out on the cross. He turns an obscene instrument of torture into a throne of glory." And this is exactly what John is doing. Everybody is going to see. Nobody is going to miss this. We get this in Luke when the two disciples on the road to Emmaus are like, "What, haven't you heard?" Everybody knows what's going on because everybody would. And everybody knew exactly why Jesus died. And it wasn't because he said he was King of the Jews. It's because he was King of the Jews. And so in this last, the last time we hear from Pilate in this scene, he says something that is so gorgeously true and he can't even know it. This is why I think there's a Christian tradition, which who knows, it's only God's business to know this. There's Christian tradition that Pilate eventually became a Christian because he said so many true things about this man on this cross. And he, it's like he couldn't help it. Again, God just moved indomitably to this point where he takes and through complete weakness, he brings about the salvation of the world. The cross as a throne doesn't make any sense unless you're God, and that's the way you do things. And the way you want to save your people who are mired in sin is through taking their sin on yourself. When we see Jesus in that robe with that crown of thorns on that cross, what we should see is a man who is soaked, completely drenched in the sin that I brought into this world. And yet that's what God uses to save us. And it's gorgeous. So beautiful.
Pastor Joshua Palmer is pastor, assistant pastor at Catalina Lutheran Church in Tucson, Arizona, and chaplain of the Hold Fast Fellowship at the University of Arizona, as he is wont to do, bringing you the goods from John chapter 19, verses 1 to 22 here on Sharper Iron. We definitely thank you for your time this morning, Pastor Palmer. And man, ha-gagrafa, what I have written, I have written. The words are not going to pass away. And which words? That the King of the Jews died for you. It's not over yet. The King of the Jews rose for you, and not just for the Jews, for the whole entire world. And ascended and reigning, the King of the Jews, the King of the world, Jesus of Nazareth is coming again for you to make good on what he paid for with this marvelous day of days. I'm Pastor Jonathan Fisk. This is Sharper Iron, and I look forward to waking up with you at that dawn.